Imad Inchasi and Mohammed Dadawi, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here today. So, Imad, I'm going to start with some of your humanitarian work that you've been doing lately. We've been talking a lot about what's going on in Syria, the tremendous humanitarian concerns that we have about the country, not to mention Palestine, which is, part of your background. But you've been traveling to the region, unlike most who don't really want to travel there right now or find it too dangerous, or been traveling to help deliver aid and assistance. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the area and what has drawn you to do that?
Well, I grew up in a refugee camp, and there's a passion when you grow up in a refugee camp. And you get the opportunity to migrate to the United States at age 17, and all the opportunities are open for you. You go to school, you graduate, you do well, and then you turn the TV set on and you see yet another crisis in the Middle East, yet another refugees are coming from Syria to all over the region, and you empathize and you sympathize and you feel hopeless, like you want to do something, but what is it that you could do? So you raise money for humanitarian organizations and so on and so forth. And then about 3 years ago, I decided on my own to go to Lebanon. That's really where my mother lives, and volunteer with Islamic Relief and go to refugee camps. It was something that helped me cope, that helped me understand what's going on, that helped me actually look deep within me that I'm doing something positive for the community. And I felt like I was in connection with my roots because my father was a refugee. He actually lived in tents. I lived in a refugee camp, but it was not necessarily tents. Took my children there. My wife was working. My daughter was working. And we came back with a totally different perspective on things. It's amazing when you lose every single thing that you have and you walk across the borders to find a safe haven, and all of a sudden life as you know it stopped to exist.
I too have visited a refugee camp, and it was an amazing experience in the northern part of Jordan, the Za'atari refugee area. And all the things that you've said, the things that have drawn you there, the connections you have, the different perspective it leads to, how do you bring that different perspective back to Oklahoma City and share that experience in a way that it helps us enhance our understanding of what's going on in the region?
Well, having lived in a refugee camp myself personally and from the family perspective, we appreciate everything we've got. At the same time, you feel to appreciate humanity. You feel to appreciate peace. You start abhorring war and violence. It's very easy to sit in our living room here in Oklahoma in a perfectly air-conditioned room, in a perfectly perfect environment, safe and secure, and advocate war. But when you're there and when you see somebody missing a limb, when you see somebody missing their parents, when you see somebody have absolutely nothing, and you come back here and you communicate that to the community, war is not a pretty thing. Bombing is not a pretty thing. Being a refugee is not a pretty thing to look at. Maybe watching it on TV sounds interesting and sound fascinating for some people, but being in it and being with those refugees gives you a totally different perspective. So you advocate here. You come here and advocate peace. You advocate interfaith, because that's really what got us here in the first place. The idea of the other and the idea of the unknown, the idea that if you're not with us, you're against us. The idea that people of other faith are, you know, out there to kill us and so on. So you come here and advocate peace, tolerance, and outreach.
Well, Mohammed, I want to pick up on something Imad said when he said to help at yet another crisis in the Middle East. I mean, you are from Morocco. You study and you teach about the Middle East at Oklahoma City University. And so I would imagine you, too, have to deal with this yet another crisis in the Middle East, in the sense that, you know, you have to help your students and others in the community understand that from a political and historical perspective. What can you add to this discussion that helps us understand that?
Well, exactly. Growing in Morocco is radically different than the Middle East, living in seemingly stable and peaceful country. But it also brings in another dimension to the issue. I mean, as we're talking about these extremist groups and their ability to recruit worldwide and becoming more of a globalized terrorist network, you see how those people, especially in those countries that did not grow up in strife, in refugee camps, in areas of conflict, joining the ranks of these extremist groups, because I believe that at the heart of it is this an identity issue, that they lack this true conviction in their beliefs. Because if you have belief in the religion, of course, and as it advocated and was revealed and so on, you don't resort to violence. It is a peaceful, humanistic religion at its core. So that's part also of the struggle. When I go back to Morocco, going to Tunisia and so on, you see these nascent experiment of democracy or democratic reforms, and you see Morocco, of course, stable country. You try to bring back to the United States because we have a problem, of course, of recruitment here in the United States. About 100 fighters or so that are fighting for ISIL right now. So you try to impart some of what you see in the region, but also try to answer some basic questions about what Islam is, what political Islam is, what are the true goals of these groups, how did they emerge. And again, the idea here is to always try to place it in its proper context, that at some point we have to deal in the Middle East with the underlying causes and not just the symptoms. Radical Islamism is just a symptom of underlying deeper, I would say, causes that have not been treated carefully. So as a political scientist, for example, I try to stress that the political solutions, the political remedies, as the imam works on spiritual or religious solutions, remedies, and questions. I work on political questions, for example, political reforms, democratization, openness, of course. And these are the things that are lacking and provide for that context for a sense of despair and hopelessness that people have and made them probably join these groups. Because I think ISIL, of course, ISIL is a terrorist, barbaric, savage group. But it also, it's a revolutionary movement from a political science movement standpoint. They're trying to establish a state. The state, of course, we don't agree with, has no basis in Islam. It's an, as I call it in my classes oftentimes, I call it the un-Islamic state and not the Islamic state. But we have to study it as a political phenomenon as well, not forgetting about the roots of the problem, which are political and, of course, at the same time, sociocultural as well.
So I want to pick up on something you said, and that is that at the heart of this issue in terms of the extremist groups becoming globalized and attracting and recruiting members from other parts of the world, including here in the United States and other parts of Europe, for example, that this is at heart an issue of identity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that and kind of connected to what you said about the sense of despair that these groups can sometimes, or these individuals can perhaps sometimes experience that lead them down this path?
Mm-hmm. As I said, the un-Islamic state, I should say, be consistent with that, has thrived in an environment in which there is a great sense of marginalization and alienation in the Middle East, especially, let's say, in Iraq, in Syria. Somebody phrased it this way, and I forgot whom, I think in Le Monde Diplomatique, and said that this is a majority Sunni that has a minority complex. So you live in a region, and when you think you're majority, you're entitled to certain rights, right or wrong, of course, but they feel that they have been dispossessed of that. Of course, we could blame different factors, United States interventionism in 2003, but that's just only tangentially. We could also blame, of course, the Iraqi government of former Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki, how sectarian it was, how corrupt, cronyistic, and all that. And all of that, again, feeds into this narrative that in order to resurrect this global ummah-like Islamic identity, you have, in a sense, to take stand against these corrupt autocratic regimes. what we're doing right now, and maybe this is something that, you know, jumping ahead, what we're doing right is not going to help, you know, alleviate the causes, but only dealing with the symptom. The identity is broken in much of the Middle East. The average age there is about 27 to 28 across the board, of course, and I'm generalizing. So this is a youthful population lacking hope, lacking job opportunities, ways by which they can express and vent their disagreements with the government, and this latest, of course, war on terrorism, although it's not called that way, whatever we want to call it, counterterrorism campaign, is only going to embolden the existing autocratic regimes to stifle the dissent. And that contribute also to further shatter that identity that doesn't feel that it is the proper Islam that they've been worshiping there or being practiced, of course, in this region.
Well, speaking of the Islam that they practice or that collectively people practice, let's talk about this issue of tolerance with the few minutes we have left. And Imad, you said something about how all your experiences have led you to become an advocate, obviously, for interfaith dialogue. I know you've been very active in that area in the region to decrease the lack of knowledge, to enhance our understanding of what you called the unknown. So tell us about that process and engaging with the community. And I know, Muhammad, you've been involved in that as well, in terms of really trying to enhance that sense of interfaith, working with other faith communities to increase tolerance of different religious beliefs.
In the Quran itself, there's passage after another. Not only, you know, I used to use the word beyond coexistence and beyond tolerance, but to love each other. We have created you from a single male and female, for instance, is one passage, and we made you into tribes and nations so you might get to know one another. A passage after another in the Quran to ask us to outreach. But personally, the verse I really would love, always like to quote, is repel evil with good, repel hate with love. But at the same time, I grew up in a refugee camp, and those people who took care of me were Christians. I grew up in Christian schools. I grew up with a Christian nun. Her name is Miss Rahma, which is Miss Mercy, actually, translation. So I found out what love is through the school that I was in. So when an act of hatred also perpetrated by those who claim to be co-religionists to the nuns came into my refugee camp and butchered 1,800 people, I questioned. They invoked the same name as the nun that fed me invoked Jesus' name as she fed me. And those people who perpetrated the act of killing 1,800 people also invoked Jesus' name as they killed the people. The Red Cross rescued me. Early on, I realized that we could never generalize about others. And at the same time, I don't want anybody to generalize about our faith as well. There's 1.7, 1.8 billion Muslims. There's not a monolithic community in Islam. And the act of love that I received helped me to be a person that outreached to others.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. I think the imam is being a little bit modest about his achievement, but he's been a major force in the state in terms of interfaith. And that's what we're trying to do sometimes at OCU and in the community at large, is bring scholars, bring people from different faiths in order to talk about their own faiths and engage in a sort of a dialogue and communicate what the faith is, what the faith is not. For us Muslims, we have to get out of this mentality of trying to define the faith in terms of what it's not, because it just takes its psychological toll, social toll at some point. Yeah. At some point, we'd like to talk about what the religion is, and I think the imam is doing a wonderful job of it in the state.
Well, I often, when in our interfaith gathering, often, you know, start my question. He says, who's the most mentioned prophet in the Quran? And everybody say Muhammad. And it's false. It's Moses. Mm-hmm. Who's coming back towards the end of time? And people say, well, Muhammad. False. It's Jesus. Mm-hmm. Who's the first lady of heaven? And people normally say Sarah or Hagar. Say, false. It's Mary. And right there, you got a captive audience to listen. What kind of religion is that?
Well, thank you both so much. These are such important topics, and the way in which we come together on these issues is really critical. So thank you so much, both of you, for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.